This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello and welcome. This is Tracy reading to you from the front page of the New York Times. Today is Wednesday, April 17. Top article today from the Middle East crisis. Israel weighs response to Iran attack, with each choice a risk. In debating how to respond to last weekend's Iranian airstrike, Israel's war cabinet is choosing between options that could deter future attacks or de-escalate hostilities, but all carry drawbacks. Article by Ronan Bergman, Isabel Kirshner, Julian E. Barnes, and Russell Goldman. Ronan Bergman reported from Tel Aviv, Isabel Kirshner from Jerusalem, Julian E. Barnes from Washington, and Russell Goldman from New York. Dateline, April 16, update, April 17, 2:23 a.m. Israeli leaders on Tuesday were debating how best to respond to Iran's unprecedented weekend airstrike, officials said, weighing a set of options calibrated to achieve different strategic outcomes, deterring a similar attack in the future, placating their American allies, and avoiding all-out war. Iran's attack on Israel, an immense barrage that included hundreds of ballistic missiles and exploding drones, changed the unspoken rules in the archrival's long-running shadow war. In that conflict, major airstrikes from one country's territory directly against the other had been avoided. Given that change in precedent, the calculus by which Israel decides its next move has also changed, said the Israeli officials who requested anonymity to discuss Iran. Quote, "We cannot stand still from this kind of aggression," Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari, a spokesman for Israel's military, said on Tuesday. Iran, he added, would not get off, quote, scot-free with this aggression. As Israel's war cabinet met to consider a military response, other countries were applying diplomatic pressure to both Israel and Iran in the hopes of de-escalating the conflict. Almost all of the missiles and drones fired in Iran's attack early on Sunday were intercepted by Israel and its allies, including the United States and Britain. The attack, Iran said, was a response to an Israeli airstrike earlier this month, in which several armed forces commanders were killed in an attack in Syria. That attack on an Iranian embassy building in Damascus was different from previous targeted assassinations of individuals in the shadow war. That strike destroyed a building that was part of an Iranian embassy complex, the sort of facility normally considered off-limits to attack. Israeli officials said the building was diplomatic in name only and used as an Iranian military and intelligence base, making it a legitimate target. Iran, which signaled that it saw the attack as an Israeli break in the norms of the shadow war, felt compelled to retaliate strongly, analysts said, in order to establish deterrence and maintain credibility with its proxies and hardline supporters. Israel does not want Iran to conclude that it can now attack Israeli territory in response to an Israeli strike on Iranian interests in a third country, some of the officials said, summarizing the internal Israeli debate. But, they added, Israel also does not want and cannot afford a major conflict with Iran while still fighting a war in Gaza and skirmishing with Iranian proxies along its borders. The members of Israel's small but fractious war cabinet, the officials said, are considering options big enough to send a clear message to Iran that such attacks will not go unanswered, but not so big as to spark a major escalation. The officials described the following options and their downsides, from which the Israeli leaders are choosing a response. Conduct an aggressive strike on an Iranian target, such as an Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps base, in a country other than Iran, like Syria. The drawback to that is it lacks the symmetry of responding to a direct attack on Israel with a direct attack on Iran. Strike a mostly symbolic target inside Iran. Such a move would likely require U.S. consultation and would risk angering the Americans who have advised against such a strike. Conduct a cyber attack on Iran's infrastructure. Doing so could expose Israel's cyber capabilities prematurely and would not be an in-kind response to a major airstrike. accelerate small attacks inside Iran, including targeted assassinations carried out by the Mossad. Israel does not claim responsibility for such attacks, so they fail to match the public nature of Iran's strike. Other Israeli options include doing nothing, a measure aimed at leveraging the international and regional alliance that came together to help repel the Iranian attack into something more solid and permanent, or adopting a more diplomatic approach, including a boycott of Iran by the United Nations Security Council, other officials said. At least two members of the cabinet argued at the time of the Iranian attack that Israel should respond immediately, two Israeli officials said, arguing that a rapid response in self-defense would give such a counterstrike obvious legitimacy. Yet, after 3 days of meetings, the cabinet has yet to decide on a response. On Tuesday, the five-member cabinet met with security officials for 2 hours of consultations, according to one official, and they were expected to convene again on Wednesday. The war cabinet discussions are shrouded in secrecy and riven by old rivalries and distrust. Its members share histories of fierce competition as well as personal and political betrayal, which can sometimes color the details that leak out. According to two officials' account, the main proponents of immediate retaliation over the weekend were Benny Gantz and Gadi Eisenkot, the two former military chiefs and now centrist political allies who crossed parliamentary lines to join the government in the interests of national unity after the October 7 Hamas-led attack on Israel. But for reasons that remain unclear, no strike took place on Sunday following the Iranian attack. American officials have publicly and privately tried to persuade Israel that it does not need to retaliate for the Iranian strike. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, they have argued, can take the win earned by a successful defense against the Iranian onslaught, which caused minimal damage and injured just one person, a young Bedouin girl. But American officials have also said they understand that persuading Israel not to retaliate may be impossible. American officials have said they understand Israeli officials believe they must respond to a direct strike from Iran on Israel in a way that the world can see. A covert attack by Israel against Iran, American officials said, would most likely not be enough to satisfy Mr. Netanyahu's coalition partners or the current Israeli government. Should that counterattack prompt another round of Iranian missiles and drones, U.S. officials said, American warplanes and naval vessels would once again come to the defense of their ally against their chief adversary in the Middle East. The United States is also backing diplomatic efforts to pressure and punish Iran, including by imposing tougher sanctions on the country in the coming days, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said at a news conference in Washington on Tuesday. Ms. Yellen declined to elaborate on what form the penalties might take, but suggested that the Biden administration was considering ways to further restrict Iranian oil exports. The United States is also looking at ways to cut off Iran's access to military components that it uses to build weapons, such as the drones that it launched toward Israel over the weekend, according to a Treasury official who declined to be named in order to discuss private deliberations. Quote, Treasury will not hesitate to work with our allies to use our sanctions authority to continue disrupting the Iranian regime's malign and destabilizing activity, Ms. Yellen said ahead of the spring meetings of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. As Israel faces pressure from its allies to avert a broader conflict with Iran, several countries, including Russia, China, and Japan, have also been urging Iran to avoid further escalation. And the European Union is considering expanding economic sanctions against Iran's weapons program to punish it for the last weekend's attack on Israel, and try to prevent any escalation of violence across the Middle East, the EU's top diplomat said on Tuesday. Quote, I'm not trying to exaggerate when I say that, in the Middle East, we are at the edge of a very deep precipice, Josep Borrell Fontelles, the EU foreign policy chief, said after a hastily called meeting of European diplomats to discuss the crisis. Reporting was contributed by Eric Schmidt, Alan Rappaport, Cassandra Vinograd, Aaron Boxerman, Christopher F. Schwitze, and Laura Jakes. Ronan Bergman is a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine based in Tel Aviv. His latest book is Rise and Kill First, The Secret History of Israel's Targeted Assassinations. Isabel Kirshner, a Times correspondent in Jerusalem, has been reporting on Israeli and Palestinian affairs since 1990. Julian E. Barnes covers the U.S. intelligence agencies and international security matters for The Times. He has written about security issues for more than two decades. Russell Goldman is a senior editor on the international desk of the New York Times, focusing on digital storytelling and breaking news and based in Hong Kong. He is a winner of the Society of Publishers in Asia Awards for Excellence. Next article. Supreme Court appears skeptical of using obstruction law to charge January 6 rioters. The justices considered the gravity of the assault and whether prosecutors have been stretching the law to reach members of the mob responsible for the attack. Article by Adam Liptak, reporting from Washington, Dateline, April 16. The Supreme Court seemed wary on Tuesday of letting prosecutors use a federal obstruction law to charge hundreds of rioters involved in the Capitol attack on January 6, 2021. A decision rejecting the government's interpretation of the law could not only disrupt those prosecutions, but also eliminate half of the charges against former President Donald J. Trump in the federal case accusing him of plotting to subvert the 2020 election. Mr. Trump's case did not come up at the argument, which was largely focused on trying to make sense of a statute enacted to address white-collar crime that all concerned agreed was not a model of clarity. But the justices' questions also considered the gravity of the assault and whether prosecutors have been stretching the law to reach members of the mob responsible for the attack, which interrupted certification of Joseph R. Biden Jr.'s electoral victory. Justice Clarence Thomas, who returned to the bench after an unexplained absence on Monday, asked whether the government was engaging in a kind of selective prosecution. Quote, "There have been many violent protests that have interfered with proceedings," he said. "Has the government applied this provision to other protests?" Justice Sonia Sotomayor took a different view of what happened on January 6. Quote, "We've never had a situation before where there's been a situation like this with people attempting to stop a proceeding violently," she said. The question for the justices was whether one of the laws used to prosecute some of the members of the mob that stormed the Capitol fits their conduct. The law, a provision of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002, contains a broad catch-all provision that makes it a crime to corruptly obstruct, influence, or impede any official proceeding. But the provision is linked to a previous one aimed at altering evidence. Chief Justice John G. Roberts, Jr. said the catch-all provision must be read in context. Since the January 6 defendants were not accused of altering evidence, he said, the catch-all provision did not apply. Other members of the court's conservative majority said that reading the catch-all provision in isolation would allow prosecutions of all sorts of protesters. Two members of the court's liberal wing responded that the catch-all provision was broad by design and not tethered to the previous clause. Congress had meant, they said, to give prosecutors tools to address situations that lawmakers could not anticipate. The effect of a ruling rejecting the use of the provision to prosecute January 6 defendants is not completely clear. Most such defendants have not been charged under their provision, which prosecutors have reserved for the most serious cases, and those who have been charged under it face other counts as well. The defendant in Tuesday's case, Joseph W. Fisher, for instance, faces six other charges. Nor is it clear that a ruling in Mr. Fisher's favor would erase any charges against Mr. Trump under the law. Jack Smith, the special counsel overseeing the federal election interference case against the former president, has said Mr. Trump's conduct could be considered a crime under even a narrow reading of the 2002 law. Whatever the larger consequences of the court's ruling expected by late June, several justices on Tuesday seemed troubled by the government's interpretation of the law, saying it would allow many other kinds of prosecutions. Quote, "Would a sit-in that disrupts a trial or access to a federal courthouse qualify?" Justice Neil M. Gorsuch asked. "Would a heckler in today's audience qualify, or at the State of the Union address?" Would pulling a fire alarm before a vote qualify for 20 years in federal prison? Justice Samuel A. Alito, Jr. allowed that, quote, what happened on January 6 was very, very serious. But he added that the prosecutor's theory could reach, say, protests in the Supreme Court's courtroom, which have occurred from time to time. Elizabeth B. Preligar, the U.S. Solicitor General, began her argument by recalling the events of January 6, saying that what some of the participants did that day amounted to obstruction covered by the law. Quote, on January 6, 2021, a violent mob stormed the United States Capitol and disrupted the peaceful transition of power, she said. Many crimes occurred that day, but in plain English, the fundamental wrong committed by many of the rioters, including petitioner, was a deliberate attempt to stop the joint session of Congress from certifying the results of the election. That is, they obstructed Congress's work in that official proceeding. Justice Amy Coney Barrett asked how to distinguish the attack on the Capitol from other actions that have disrupted official proceedings. Quote, tell me why I shouldn't be concerned about the breadth of the government's reading, she asked. The law at issue in the case was enacted in the wake of the collapse of the energy giant Enron. Mr. Fisher, a former police officer, was charged with violating it and with six other crimes. Justice Brett M. Kavanaugh asked why the other charges were insufficient. Quote, why aren't those six counts good enough just from the Justice Department's perspective, given that they don't have any of the hurdles? He asked. Ms. Preligar responded that the other counts did not fully reflect Mr. Fisher's culpability. The law was prompted by accounting fraud and the destruction of documents, but the provision is written in broad terms. At least part of what the law meant to accomplish was to address a gap in the federal criminal code. It was a crime to persuade others to destroy records relevant to an investigation or official proceeding, but not to do so oneself. The law sought to close that gap. It did so in a two-part provision. The first part makes it a crime to corruptly alter, destroy, or conceal evidence to frustrate official proceedings. The second part, at issue in Mr. Fisher's case, makes it a crime, quote, otherwise, to corruptly obstruct, influence, or impede any official proceeding. The heart of the case is at the pivot from the first part to the second. The ordinary meaning of otherwise, prosecutors say, is in a different manner. That means, they say, that the obstruction of official proceedings need not involve the destruction of evidence. The second part, they say, is a broad catch-all applying to all sorts of conduct. Justice Elena Kagan said the catch-all provision was a purposefully broad reaction to the Enron debacle. Quote, what Enron convinced them of was that there were gaps in these statutes, she said of the lawmakers who enacted it. She added, but they didn't know exactly what those gaps were, so they said, let's have a backstop provision, and this is their backstop provision. Justice Sotomayor agreed. They wanted to cover every base, and they didn't do it in a logical way, but they managed to cover every base, she said. Jeffrey T. Green, lawyer for Mr. Fisher, said the court should not interpret the 2002 law to create a crime of breathtaking scope that would allow prosecutors to charge political protesters and others with felonies carrying 20-year prison sentences. He said that the first part of the provision must inform and limit the second one, to obstruction linked to the destruction of evidence. They would read otherwise, in other words, as similarly. Chief Justice John G. Roberts, Jr., citing a unanimous opinion he wrote last week, appeared to agree. Quote, the general phrase, he said, is controlled and defined by reference to the terms that precede it, he said. The otherwise phrase is more general, and the terms that precede it are alters, destroys, mutilates, or conceals a record or document. The case is one of several on the court's docket this term affecting or involving Mr. Trump. In a separate case to be argued next week, the justices will consider Mr. Trump's claim that he is totally immune from prosecution. Mr. Fisher is accused of entering the Capitol around 3:24 p.m. on January 6, with the counting of electoral ballots having been suspended after the initial assault. He had told a superior in a text message, prosecutors said, that, quote, it might get violent. In another, he wrote, they should storm the Capitol and drag all the Democrats into the street and have a mob trial. Prosecutors say that videos showed Mr. Fisher yelling charge before pushing through the crowd, using a vulgar term to berate police officers and crashing into a line of them. Mr. Fisher's lawyers dispute some of this, but the question for the justices is legal, not factual. Does the 2002 law cover what Mr. Fisher is accused of? As the end of the argument neared, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, a liberal, indicated that she had reservations about the government's position, saying that the court should not lose sight of, quote, the backdrop of a real-world context. It was in the wake of Enron, she said. There was document destruction, and, you know, there was nothing, as far as I can tell, in the enactment history as it was recorded, that suggests that Congress was thinking about obstruction more generally. Adam Liptak covers the Supreme Court and writes Sidebar, a column on legal developments. A graduate of Yale Law School, he practiced law for 14 years before joining the Times in 2002. Next article. The House Republican going after universities on anti-Semitism. Representative Virginia Fox is a blunt partisan, but her life in rural North Carolina informs her attacks against these schools, starting with whether Harvard is truly elite. Article by Anamona Hartikoulis. For this story, Anamona Hartikoulis traveled to the Blue Ridge Mountains of northwestern North Carolina, part of Representative Fox's district. Dateline, April 16. Virginia Fox, the Republican Congresswoman from North Carolina, has spent the last few months giving elite schools a hard time. As the chairwoman of the House Committee on Education, she oversaw a tense hearing in December that spurred the resignations of the presidents of University of Pennsylvania and Harvard. She has led an investigation of a half dozen institutions for their handling of anti-Semitism claims. She has subpoenaed internal documents and called Jewish students to testify. On Wednesday, she'll preside over another hearing, this time with officials at Columbia University. The drubbing is part of a campaign by Republicans against what they view as double standards within elite education establishments, practices that they say favor some groups over others, and equity over meritocracy. Others see it as a partisan attack. Representative Fox, 80, does not like the term elite and questions whether these schools even deserve the title. Quote, I call them the most expensive universities in the country, she said the other day while traveling around her district, which winds through small working-class towns in the Blue Ridge Mountains. She is known for her conservative views and blunt manner, but her current work, she said, is rooted in personal experience. Over her years in office, she has repeatedly told her life story of growing up in a sparsely populated rural area in a house without running water or electricity. She and her brother, Butch, carried drinking water from a spring. There was no outhouse, so, quote, we went to the woods, she recalled. She went on to junior college, state college, and graduate school, eventually earning a doctorate from the University of North Carolina, leveraging her way into intertwined careers in politics and education, becoming president of a community college. But it is her religious beliefs and identification with the underdog, she said, that inform how she is dealing with the bitter campus protests over the Israel-Hamas war. Quote, the people here believe that the Jews are God's chosen people, and I grew up in the Baptist church believing that, she said. After reading news accounts last fall of rising anti-Semitism on prominent campuses, she said that she resolved to investigate these institutions that most of her constituents cannot imagine ever attending. Quote, it was unconscionable what was happening, she said. Students were unsafe, and the administration was doing nothing to help them. As chair of the committee, she said, how do I ignore that? Others see a not-so-hidden agenda. Quote, Both sides are using higher education as proxies in a culture war, said John Fansmith, head of government relations for the American Council on Education, a trade association. Quote, and to a real degree, we've seen that reflected in this Congress and the Education and Workforce Committee in a way we haven't before. She sets the agenda. Representative Fox represents a solidly Republican district in a purple state, and her views reflect that. She is against abortion rights and against allowing trans women to compete on women's teams in college sports. She has said she has little tolerance for students who graduate from college with large student loan debt. Arguing against a hate crimes bill in 2009, she called it a hoax to say that Matthew Shepard, a University of Wyoming student, had been killed a decade earlier because he was gay. After an outcry, she apologized to his mother. She voted against federal aid for New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, and once said there was more to fear from Obamacare than from terrorists. When a reporter asked about Republican efforts to overturn the 2020 election at a news conference, the Congresswoman told her to, quote, shut up. In a district tour along curvy, two-lane mountain roads, she seemed eager to show a softer side, bringing a favorite cousin, Helen Pritchard. Dr. Fox was born in New York City, the first of four children to parents who never made it past ninth grade. Her father, Nunzio Palmieri, a construction worker, was a son of Italian immigrants in New York. Her mother, Dolly Garrison, was the daughter of a coal miner. In 1950, when she was six, they moved to Western North Carolina, living in a house shared with Ms. Pritchard's family. To get there, quote, you had to ford the river and then open two cattle gates, Dr. Fogg said. No, seven, Ms. Pritchard corrected. Just then, the driver yielded for a barking dog that was blocking the car. Go forward, Dr. Fox urged. You can't be cowed by a dog. That dog has got enough sense to get out of your way. In high school, a teacher gave her a list of 100 classic books to read, advising her to go to college and marry a man with a degree. She listened. She married Tom Fox at 20 and had a daughter. It took her seven circuitous years to earn her bachelor's degree in English from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, working the whole way. She went on to earn a master's in sociology from Chapel Hill and a doctorate in education from the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. Her brother had a different trajectory, becoming a carpenter. Because of him, she considers it her mandate to help people who are, as she put it, undegreed. Quote, there are millions of people in this country who say the same thing my brother would say. I don't want to be a second-class citizen, she said. In the same vein, she forbids her staff to use the T word, training, instead of education. Quote, you train dogs and you educate people, she said. Electrician, plumber, I don't care what the skill is. You need a person who can think. Her political career began in the mid-70s after a friend challenged her to run for school board. When she said she was not qualified, he replied, you mean you're not as qualified as those turkeys? Quote, like many women, I doubted my capabilities, she says now. With her husband's encouragement, she won in 1976 and remained on the board for 12 years. As an assistant dean at Appalachian State, she campaigned for the Equal Rights Amendment, incensed by a tire salesman who refused to give her a line of credit without her husband's authorization. I thought, well, this is wrong, she says now. I can understand why there were people who were skeptical of the ERA, but at the time, I was a supporter. On leave from the relatively liberal outpost at Appalachian State in the mid-80s and working for a Republican governor, she won the presidency of Mayland Community College. She is touchy about anything that implies community colleges are lower status institutions. Quote, community colleges in particular use the T word a lot, she said. Her loyalty to these institutions is real, said Peter Lake, director of the Center for Excellence in Higher Education Law and Policy at Stetson University College of Law. Quote, The community college world sometimes have felt like they were the second cousins at the third table, he said. Her 7-year tenure at Mayland, however, was dogged by a lawsuit accusing the college of purging Democratic administrators and faculty, using financial pressure as a pretext. She says now that she did not care about their political affiliation and would have guessed they were Republican, because almost everybody was. A jury found for her and the trustees. In an interview, John West Gresham, a lawyer for the plaintiffs, said the faculty, quote, were good people. She was so partisan, he said, that he thinks her concerns about anti-Semitism are more about politics. Quote, it casts those liberal universities in a bad light, doesn't it? He said. Her political savvy helped lead to a stint in the state legislature before she entered Congress in 2005. And her latest crusade has vaulted her from local to national news. She said that she did not anticipate that the December 5 hearing would have such an impact. The presidents of Harvard, MIT, and Penn were asked, hypothetically, if they would punish students who called for the genocide of Jews. They infamously answered that it would depend on the context. Widely criticized and vulnerable for other reasons, Harvard's Claudine Gay and Penn's Elizabeth McGill resigned. On Wednesday, the committee has scheduled a hearing with the president of Columbia University, Nimat Minoshi Shafiq. Quote, no one escapes, Dr. Fox said. Her last district stop is her house on a hill with spectacular views of Grandfather Mountain. She explained her dedication to exposing anti-Semitism over tea and Pepperidge Farm cookies. She said discrimination of any kind is wrong, and she knows her Old Testament, paraphrasing Genesis 12:3. Quote, there are verses in the Bible that ministers will quote, that if you bless the Jewish people, you will be blessed, she said. If you curse the Jewish people, you will be cursed. Many of her constituents feel the same, she said. I believe that I'm representing the community. Kirsten Noyes, Sheila McGill, and Jack Begg contributed research. Anna Mona Hartikolas is a national reporter for The Times covering higher education. Next article. New migrants get work permits. Other undocumented immigrants want them too. Long-term undocumented immigrants and their employers are feeling left out by Biden administration policies allowing most who just crossed the border to work legally. Article by Miriam Jordan and Lydia DePillis, Dateline, April 15. Sam Sanchez, a Chicago restaurateur, was incensed when President Biden announced last September that his administration would extend work eligibility to nearly 500,000 Venezuelans, many of them migrants who had recently crossed the border illegally. What about his undocumented employees, like Ruben, a Mexican father of 2 U.S.-born children, who's been in the United States since 1987, and Juan, another Mexican worker, who's trained dozens of new hires at Moe's Cantina? Quote, it's offensive that my employees and other immigrants are being leapfrogged by new arrivals, said Mr. Sanchez, who is on the board of the National Restaurant Association. Having built lives and families since entering the country unlawfully many years ago, they've been waiting for Congress to give them a path to work legally. Quote, for those of us here a long time, trying to do everything right, it's just not fair that we are forgotten, said Juan, 53, whose last name was withheld out of concern about his immigration status. Confronted with an influx of migrants making their way to Chicago, New York, and other big cities, Mr. Biden has used executive power to allow several hundred thousand of them to live and work temporarily in the United States in an effort to make them less reliant on shelters and other assistance. Now groups representing undocumented immigrants and their U.S. citizen children, as well as their employers, are urging the president to deploy the same broad power to open channels for more than 8 million living in the United States who are barred from legal employment. Quote, if President Biden can grant work permits to new arrivals, he can do it for people picking our crops, emptying bedpans, and cleaning hotel rooms for more than 10 years, said Rebecca Shee, executive director of the American Business Immigration Coalition, whose 1,400 members include business associations and company executives. Business leaders have lobbied Republicans and Democrats on Capitol Hill for decades to overhaul the broken immigration system and address their labor needs. But the calls have gone nowhere in an increasingly polarized Congress. At a rally in Chicago last month, demonstrators urged the Biden administration to allow undocumented immigrants to work legally. And in Las Vegas, Nevada's governor, a Republican, and the state's U.S. senators, both Democrats, joined employers, unions, and immigrant advocates to send the same message. The Business Coalition, in a letter to the president signed by more than 300 employers and trade associations, urged, quote, immediate action to extend work authorization to long-term undocumented people. In particular, as she said, the president should prioritize work permits for those without legal status. More than 1 million undocumented spouses of U.S. citizens, 800,000 parents of U.S. citizen children, and 300,000 farm workers. About three-quarters of the 10.5 million undocumented people in the United States as of 2021 were in the labor force, according to the Pew Research Center, an independent think tank. Roughly 2 million people out of the overall undocumented population have a temporary legal status that makes them eligible to work. But a sweeping action by the president to allow millions more to work legally could prompt court challenges and political attacks from critics, even as some of those same critics have stymied or undermined the administration's efforts. Mr. Biden's latest proposal, a bill this year to curb unlawful migration, was backed by top Republicans in Congress, but it collapsed after Republican leaders withdrew support, bowing to pressure from former President Donald J. Trump, their party's presumptive presidential nominee. The surge in migration to the United States has left Mr. Biden with no easy options. The perception that he is favoring newcomers over longtime undocumented immigrants could hurt him among Latino voters, long a Democratic bloc that has begun to fragment, with an increasing number supporting Republican candidates. Eduardo Gamera, a professor at Florida International University who recently polled Latino voters, said that some of them who have settled in the United States may see themselves as having less in common with the new immigrants. Quote, when you try to say, why are you supporting these positions? They will tell you, one, we don't like illegals, even though they might have been illegal themselves, Dr. Gamara said. Channels exist for foreigners to immigrate legally to the United States, but they are available primarily to those who have specialized skills or family already in the country. Meanwhile, international crises have pushed millions of people toward the U.S. border. Haiti, Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua have endured years of political and economic turbulence. Over the last year, President Biden has used humanitarian parole to allow about 390,000 people from those countries to come to the United States and receive work authorization, provided they have a financial sponsor. Hundreds of thousands of other Venezuelans who have fled their country have received what is known as temporary protected status, which has helped Venezuelans leave shelters as they receive work permits. To better manage the flow of migrants, the Biden administration has promoted a smartphone app that since last year has granted parole to those who use it to schedule appointments at the border, creating another way for migrants to obtain work eligibility. Margaret Stock, an immigration lawyer, said that the president has legal authority to authorize employment for others. Quote, he may be reluctant, but Biden could grant parole and work permits to whoever he wanted, she said. A White House spokesman, Angelo Fernandez Hernandez, responded in general terms when asked about the push for work permits, saying that Congress had failed to consider the president's 2021 proposal to reform immigration, and that, quote, the administration is constantly evaluating possible policy options. Obtaining a work permit opens a wider range of opportunities and raises immigrant wages by 10% on average, research shows. Those who have lived unlawfully in the United States for decades typically work off the books, or present documents under a fake or stolen name to get hired, which is illegal. It has become more difficult to do that because about half of all states require employers to use an electronic system to detect irregularities. Business owners like Mr. Sanchez, who employ people without valid work documents, have become increasingly vocal about the plight of their workers and their struggle filling jobs amid a labor shortage. And although more seasonal guest worker visas have been issued in recent years for some sectors, like agriculture, employers say that granting work permits to long-time unauthorized immigrants would do more to address the problem. Quote, "We have operations that want to grow," said Matt Teagarden, chief executive of the Kansas Livestock Association. "Labor is a limiting factor." The billions of dollars that undocumented immigrants contribute to public coffers has heightened the sense that Mr. Biden's recent efforts for newcomers are unfair. According to an analysis of 2021 census data by the American Immigration Council, undocumented workers paid $31 billion in federal, state, and local taxes, including into the Social Security system, from which they cannot draw retirement benefits. Arindira Rendon, whose parents are undocumented Mexicans in their late 60s, has watched mayors press the White House to issue work permits to recently arrived migrants straining municipal resources. Her mother, Jared Pickles, and her father worked in a slaughterhouse. They put two children through college and bought a home. Because they cannot receive retirement benefits, they depend on their children to help them. Quote, "I wish the mayors were advocating as loudly for undocumented people who have been here all these years," said Ms. Rendon, 38, who works for a nonprofit in Chicago called the Resurrection Project that helps new migrants complete work permit applications. For some immigrants, new migrants also create competition for jobs. Although research generally shows that immigrants do not depress wages overall, there can be short-term effects on similar workers. The dynamic is palpable in New York City, at the corners where immigrants hustle for work. Lucio Goyen, director of day laborer programs at Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of New York, says newcomers will often accept just a few dollars an hour, lowering wages for everyone. When new arrivals receive work permits, they are free to find a job in the formal economy that is still off limits to many who have been in the city far longer. Quote, "There has been this frustration of, I've been here 20, 30 years. I have no access to a work permit, but this is a growing list of things that new migrants are getting handed to them," Ms. Goyen said. Miriam Jordan reports from a grassroots perspective on immigrants and their impact on the demographics, society, and economy of the United States. Lydia DePillis reports on the American economy. She has been a journalist since 2009. Next article. Dozens of major bridges lack shields to block wayward ships. The collapse of the Key Bridge in Baltimore has prompted a reassessment of critical bridges around the country that may be similarly vulnerable to a ship strike. Article by Mike Baker, Anjali Singhvi, Helmuth Rosales, David W. Chen, and Elena Shao. Dateline, April 6. The Lewis and Clark Bridge has towered above the Columbia River for nearly a century, its rugged half-mile truss serving as a gateway for logging trucks and beach vacationers crossing between Washington and Oregon. Decades ago, to protect against wayward vessels that could threaten the structure, crews installed timber shields around the bridge piers that rise up out of the water. But even as the cargo ships chugging up the Pacific Northwest's largest river began to grow in size, the timbers rotted away, leaving the bridge vulnerable to disaster. Quote, "If a ship hits one of those piers, it's gone," said Jerry Rigor, a semi-retired contractor who lives near the bridge and has spent years pressing transportation officials to install new protections. The state views the risk of calamity as low and the cost of preventing it to be high. Bridges across the country carry similar deficiencies. At 309 major bridges on navigable waterways in the United States, inspections in recent years have found protection systems around bridge foundations that were deteriorating, potentially outdated, or non-existent, leaving the structures perilously exposed to ship strikes. A New York Times analysis of federal data and shipping traffic found dozens of these vulnerable bridges spanning waterways that serve as corridors for large vessels around places like Boston, New Orleans, and Philadelphia. The review identified 193 bridges that each carried 10,000 vehicles or more a day that have no protections installed around the piers planted in river and seabeds that hold up the bridges. The potential risk became starkly apparent last month when a cargo vessel appeared to lose power and struck a pier of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore, causing much of the 1.6-mile structure to collapse into the water and killing six people. But the Times review showed that bridges across the country have suffered similar catastrophic failures in recent decades in places like Tampa Bay, Florida, Mobile, Alabama, South Padre Island, Texas, and Weber's Falls, Oklahoma. Those costly and sometimes deadly disasters have brought calls to enhance bridge protections. The Biden administration in 2021 pushed through legislation that will provide $40 billion to repair or replace bridges across the country. But the repairs are targeted at only about a third of an estimated 43,000 bridges deemed to be in poor condition. And states have struggled to pay for multi-million dollar safety improvements, constantly balancing the cost against what may be seen as an isolated risk of disaster. Department of Transportation officials in Washington state have said they will be watching the Baltimore investigation to determine whether new pier protections on the Lewis and Clark Bridge might be needed, but cautioned that the state has limited funds. Quote, "This would be an improvement project that would cost tens of millions of dollars," said Kelly Hanahan, a department spokeswoman. Some states have focused less on upgrading their bridges and instead are working on plans to evacuate them quickly in the event of a ship strike or other problem. Some are concentrating on improving navigation and tugboat protocols to lessen the likelihood of collisions. Others are rolling the dice. Crescent City connections. Shortfalls near key ports. Vulnerable bridges are standing in some of the busiest shipping waterways. One example, the Crescent City Connection in New Orleans. The bridge has two spans, one built in 1958 and another in 1988. Both were completed before the adoption of more modern standards to mitigate the risk of a large vessel collision. A pair of private engineering researchers started looking at the bridge and two others nearby in the 1990s after a series of vessel accidents, including some involving ships that lost power, as was most likely the case with the ship in Baltimore. In findings published for their peers, they found that the protection systems around the bridges, quote, "do not have the strength and energy absorption capacity to affect the consequences of major vessel collisions," and that the bridge's foundations might not survive a head-on collision. The Times analysis found bridges with similar documented flaws at a variety of other big ports. In Florida, where the Dolphin Expressway carries more than 50,000 vehicles per day across the Miami River, the bridge supports are protected by what inspectors have described as a deteriorating system. The transportation agency managing the bridge said it is working to replace the protection system. The Burlington-Bristol Bridge, preparing for evacuations. Many of the deficiencies found in bridges outside of the nation's major ports are also a result of deteriorating barriers around the piers. It was a problem that inspectors identified at 98 major bridges, those carrying at least 10,000 vehicles per day. In many cases, local officials are looking at alternatives to expensive new construction to help lower the risk. In 2015, a 600-foot freighter lost propulsion as it traveled along the Delaware River between New Jersey and Pennsylvania. Seconds before the vessel reached the Burlington-Bristol Bridge, it crashed into the riverbank instead, averting disaster. The span is one of several along the Delaware River, including the Tacony-Palmyra Bridge and the Ben Franklin Bridge, both gateways to Philadelphia, where inspectors found deteriorated protection systems around the bridge piers. Michael McCorin, the director of operations at the Burlington County Bridge Commission, said repair work this year will involve some attention to the bridge's protection system. At the same time, the county is focusing on how to evacuate the bridges in the event of a looming collision, using tower operators who are in constant communication with vessels and a police force always at the ready. Time is of the essence, he said. Farther down the river, at the Delaware Memorial Bridge, crews are building one of the nation's most advanced protection systems. That $93 million project includes concrete dolphins, each 80 feet in diameter and rooted 45 feet deep in the riverbed, that will guide any troubled ships away from the bridge. After a freighter knocked down Florida's Sunshine Skyway Bridge in 1980, killing 35 people, the rebuilt span also included a network of concrete islands for protection. The Tobin Bridge, new risk assessments. In the days after last month's disaster in Baltimore, officials in Massachusetts began taking a fresh look at Boston's Tobin Bridge, a truss span that carries more than 40,000 vehicles each day across the Mystic River, but does not have a protection system for its piers. Jonathan Gulliver, the highway administrator at the Massachusetts Department of Transportation, said he is confident that the navigation protocols imposed on ships operating in the area, including tugboat escorts for large vessels, can assure safe operations. But in the aftermath of the Baltimore disaster, he said, his agency's engineers are reevaluating the potential risks. Quote, if we think there is a serious public safety risk there, we will absolutely take action, he said. Other bridges are also getting fresh consideration. Outside of Philadelphia, the Delaware Riverport Authority is expediting a safety review that had already been planned for the Commodore Barry Bridge. The authority buttressed the bridge's piers with islands of rocks in 2008. But the engineers will now examine whether more protections are necessary. Both the Tobin Bridge and the Commodore Barry Bridge have fracture-critical designs, meaning that the failure of a key component would probably cause a wider collapse of the span. The Times found that about half of the major bridges with deficient pier protections were also fracture-critical. But bridge design engineers note that the collapse of a pier would be sufficient to take out almost any bridge. I-40 collapse, crashes on inland waterways. Just 4 days after the Baltimore Bridge collapse, a barge that drifted off course on the Arkansas River rammed into a highway bridge near Sallisaw, Oklahoma. The bridge survived, thanks in part to a more robust pier design that a bridge engineer said made the structure capable of handling a collision. Just up the river in 2002, freight barges struck a pier supporting Interstate 40, knocking a section into the river and killing 14 people. While inland routes, such as the Arkansas River, the Missouri River, and the Mississippi River, do not get the larger container ships seen at coastal ports, they regularly carry barges large enough to take out a bridge. Many of the bridges on these large inland waterways do not have protection systems, inspectors have found, including the Sherman-Minton Bridge that connects Indiana and Kentucky, the Memphis-Arkansas Bridge in Tennessee, and the Robert C. Byrd Bridge linking West Virginia and Ohio. And the risks associated with large container vessels are also moving into new areas of the country, as smaller coastal ports take steps to accommodate them. In Louisiana, large cargo vessels now make their way up the Mississippi River, passing through two bridges that have been found during inspections to have flawed protection systems, the Veterans Memorial Bridge near Gramercy and the Sunshine Bridge a little further upriver in St. James Parish. In New York, the Mid-Hudson Bridge near Poughkeepsie now sees a small but steady stream of large ships passing under its span. There are other bridges along that same route, including the Kingston-Rhinecliff and the Newburgh Beacon Bridges. Inspections have shown that all of these bridges lack pier protection systems. Chris Staber, a spokesman for the New York State Bridge Authority, said all of the bridges are structurally safe and noted that the ships that use that stretch of river are not as large as the vessel involved in Baltimore. But John Lipscomb, a longtime patrol boat captain and vice president of Riverkeeper, an environmental group, recalled a 2012 incident in which a 600-foot-long oil tanker ran aground near the port of Albany. Quote, accidents happen here at home, and in light of the Baltimore accident, we should be revisiting our existing bridges and determining whether they are safe, he said. A damaged bridge has enormous consequences. There's a potential for high, high risks to the environment. The Chesapeake Bay Bridge. Protections may be insufficient. The Francis Scott Key Bridge that was destroyed in Baltimore was officially listed in the National Bridge Inventory as having a protection system in place, but the shields were limited to concrete islands that were much smaller than more modern systems. Now, even on bridges deemed to have functioning protection systems, it is unclear whether the protections are sufficient. A good example is the 4-mile-long Chesapeake Bay Bridge, also in Maryland. The bridge is, quote, not protected the way it should be, said Vijaya Gopu, a civil engineering professor at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. Quote, maybe it's protected in a very trivial fashion, like the Key Bridge, but I didn't realize it does not have a robust protection system like dolphins or some rock island, he said. That's something they have to do right away. The Maryland Department of Transportation said it was, quote, evaluating potential short-term and long-term mitigation strategies for the Bay Bridge. The department also said it would strongly consider any recommendations from the National Transportation Safety Board's investigation in Baltimore, where preliminary findings are expected later this month. Back in the Pacific Northwest, farther down the Columbia River, the Astoria Maegler Bridge has shields in place to deflect ships away from the piers, and inspectors have found them to be functioning. But vessel sizes have increased in recent years, state officials acknowledged. Captain Jeremy Nielsen, president of the Columbia River Pilots, whose mariners are hired to guide ships through the sometimes treacherous waters of the lower Columbia and Willamette Rivers, said he has concern over both bridges, given that ships can and do break down on the river. The shields on the Astoria Maegler Bridge are capable of deflecting smaller ships navigating the river, he said. Quote, the structure that's there is not going to protect against a larger vessel, end quote. Methodology note, the New York Times used 2023 data from the National Bridge Inventory, a state-reported database compiled by the Federal Highway Administration to analyze thousands of bridges across the United States. Reporters identified more than 300 major bridges that had pier protection systems that were considered deficient in the federal database. The bridges had a pier or abutment protection rating that fell into one of three categories: in place but in a deteriorated condition, in place but with reevaluation of design suggested, none present but reevaluation suggested. All bridges in the analysis were over navigable waterways, had more than 30 feet of vertical clearance below the roadway, and saw average daily vehicle traffic of 10,000 or more. That wraps up our time today and is the end of the article. So it's been a pleasure reading to you as always, and I look forward to our time together next week. In the meantime, I wish you the best.